Family Family Sing. Job. Sing. Ho. Drop your heart. Drop your heart. Drop your heart. Drop your heart. Yeah, God. Job. Job.
CKLN. We are live on the net. My name is Audrey Wandolo. I'm your host for Amandla today. And it's funny, I was just following up on the conversation Norman was just having in terms of the end of the world. And I sort of feel like the end of the world it can't come yet. There's so many things going on in Africa, so many sort of people waiting for the next step and for the people of Africa to be free and to move forward and live a good life. So I guess in two ways I can understand people saying if this rapture comes, hopefully all the people in Africa who have suffered for all this atrocities that I think we have all been part of are finally going to be free. Or if not, then I think it is a wake-up call that there is lots of work to be done and we need to move forward on reshaping the continent and also giving back the things that we have taken from the continent. So today I thought that I would fill your head with a whole bunch of news, because I think sometimes it's hard because we don't often get a chance to hear about everything that is going on in the continent. And sometimes when we do, it's only that from a certain perspective, from the mainstream perspective. And I think sometimes one of the things I think that we can do as people who are wanting to protect the rights of other people is to actually be a witness and hear the news and pay attention to what's happening. Because I think one of the atrocities that happens is that we become silent and we don't get to hear those stories. And so things continually keep on happening to people because we don't take the chance to listen out. So we're going to start off with there is African Barrick Gold. It's a division of Toronto-based Barrick Gold. Said on Tuesday that seven intruders were killed and a dozen more were injured Monday in North Mara mine, which is in Tanzania. The company said 800 criminal intruders were trying to steal ore from the mine when police were called. It says the thieves attacked the police with machetes, rocks, and hammers. African Barrick said the police had increased their presence in the area and they're investigating. So if you know much of the African Barrick Gold and also you want to join the conversation later on, maybe you can call us at CKLN. The number again is 416-595-1655 to sort of share some of the news that you're hearing about everything else that's happening in the continent. And sometimes we forget that most of the companies that are owned, who own land or who own these natural resources in the continent, are actually based, in Canada, in the U.S., in Europe. So I think a part of it is also paying attention to what's happening and who's owning what, and making sure that, the same legal rights that we have here in Canada, we are affording the same rights to the people who are in the continent. Now, we're going to move over to South Africa. So South African mediators are worried about Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe's failing health and the impact it might have on the power-sharing government. Negotiators are also concerned about the succession law should Mugambi die or retire before the adoption of a new constitution, which is still being negotiated. This was said by the African National Congress on their website. Mugambi, the 87-year-old leader, has traveled to Singapore at least four times this year for medical attention. Although he denies reports that he may be in a poor state of health. The veteran leader has been in power since 1980 and is locked in a power-share government with his former rival, President Minister Morgan Tsvangirai. The 2008 deal brokered by regional leaders included requirements for a new constitution and amended media and election laws before new polls are held. So I think there's a lot of stuff going on, again, with Mugambi, and if he is of ill health, and it proves that he's of ill health, we hope that him and his family are keeping well, because we don't want anybody to, we don't want to lose anybody in this year. I think there's a lot of work to be done, and partnership and cooperation is always a huge thing, I think, in the African continent. Now we're going over to news from the United Nations. The African economy will grow by 5% in 2011 as it steps up its recovery from the global crisis, but the new spurt will not be enough to significantly cut jobless rates, said the UN on Monday. Countries with oil and other in-demand commodities are leading the new expansion, said a report by the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa and the African Union. The GDP, the gross domestic product growth rate, predicted for the continent was up from 4.7% in 2010, when highly commodity prices and demand propelled a sharp uprise. Africa's oil exporting countries perform better than those that have no commodities, said the report. West Africa and East Africa are tipped to be the fastest growing regions in 2011 as they were last year. But the report said the higher 2011 growth rates are below those that Africa saw before the 2008-2009 financial and economic crises. They also seem to be below the rates needed to significantly reduce the continent's unemployment and poverty. The outlook for 2011 and beyond will depend strongly on the pace and duration of the growth in Africa's major trading partners. So that's Europe, North America, and the new Asian economic powerhouse. The UN and the African Union report again highlighted that Africa's heavy dependence on natural resource exports poses difficulty and persistent problems in generating growth and making sure it is shared across the continent. And again, I think that sort of speaks to what I was talking about earlier, that, you know, again, the need for people who are in Europe, in North America, in Asia, to make sure that we, even though we are enjoying the type of lifestyle that we're living, that we're not doing on the backs of other people, particularly people from the African continent. The other thing that we should speak about, I'm just going to interject for a little bit, is on next week, which is May the 28th, we are celebrating African Liberation Day. So I think the part of the African Liberation Day is sort of, it's about recognizing the independence of African states. But it's also about the people. It's also about the voice. And again, it's also about the idea of witnessing what is going on, being a witness to that and moving issues forward in partnership with the people of the continent. So in celebration and in creating a space, Grilla and Amanda will be hosting an event on the 28th at a different book list, which is next Saturday. We are running from about 5 to about 7 p.m. And we hope that you join us there. But we're going to continue on with some of the news that's happening in African continent. Excuse me. So we're going to South Africa. So South Africa is to host the world's richest golf event. South Africa will be will host its biggest golfing tournament yet, with the multi-million dollar World Golf Championships that's being played in the country in 2012. The event will draw the top 70 golfers from around the world. The new addition to the country's golfing calendar has been brought about after much negotiation between the U.S. PGA Tour, the International Federation of PGA Tours, and Sunshine Tours in Augusta, Georgia, U.S. The commissioner of Sunshine Tours said on his return from Augusta, "This is without a doubt the most significant milestone in the history of professional golf in South Africa. It is something that we as the Sunshine Tour has been working on for a long time, and the unanimous support that we have received from other professional tours around the world confirms the major standing of our players and the Sunshine Tour." The major golfing championships will be known as a Tournament of Hope and will raise awareness of poverty in Africa and the HIV/AIDS epidemic. The dates and the venues for the tournament have yet to be determined or announced. So I guess maybe some people will share their thoughts around that, because I'm of two minds there. One, you know, I think that when people recognize that, you know, with the World Cup and with any other major sports event that are happening, that it can be held in Africa, I'm in support. Of course, I'm hesitant in terms of who is going to be able to participate, especially we know the PGA Tours, and also I really hope that the organizers make way for people from the continent to be able to be spectators and also possibly participants. Because I think that it would be good for people from the continent to be able to see that they can be part of this event, and just not, it's not just about people just wanting to receive charity, because I think that there's lots of great talent in various sports from people coming from the continent. Now we're going to go over to Ghana. Ghana highlights unity during the Day of Thanksgiving. The government of Ghana and opposition parties declare Monday of a Day of Thanksgiving for the unity of the West African country. It comes 1 week after Ghana marked its 54th anniversary of independence from Britain. There were several hours of national prayer to thank God for keeping Ghana stable. For the first time, President John Adam Mills of the ruling National Democratic Congress Party and former President John Agenyu Kufuor of the New Patriotic Party met to calm down the tensions, to talk to one another about how to best move the country forward. Ghana stands in contrast to neighboring Ivory Coast, which has been brought to a standstill by last November's disputed presidential election. Civil leaders fear overheated rhetoric between the government and opposition could endanger next year's elections. Many Ghanaians are worried that divisive political rhetoric could scare investors or lead to violence during its own polls scheduled for next year. Ivory Coast is in crisis, and people are worried that with some of these statements, it could raise tensions so high that when elections are arranged for next year, things could get out of hand. So again, Ghana is highlighting and celebrating a Day of Thanksgiving. It's amazing, I think, sometimes too, that you know, when you look at people wanting to be involved in the political process in the continent, and people being, you know, willing to really sort of stand and march, and some people put their lives on the line for what is right. It just, again, it's one of those reminders of being involved in the political process here, and supporting people and making sure that when we are, you know, looking at elections and we are looking at voting, it is really about a change in our lives and the lives of the people around us, and how we want our country here to interact with other countries. So I just, again, just a reminder, because I know we just left the election a couple months ago. So we're going to go over to Latin America, and particularly Latin America is boosting ties with Africa. So it seems like, again, everybody's sort of in the continent. I think we have to sort of just make sure that the reason that they're there again is to make sure that they're also protecting the rights of the people from the continent, and making sure that the people are gaining, you know, in employment and gaining those sort of those resources and all those things that we want for ourselves, we want for our children, we want for our family. And so visits to Senegal this week by Bolivian President Evo Morales and Brazilian ex-president Lula da Silva highlight what analysts say is Latin America's growing geopolitical interest in Africa. President of Bolivia and former president of Brazil. The cries of Ole that pierced the Senegalese air before a rally Monday are an exotic noise to this continent that boosts only one Spanish-speaking country and but a handful of countries that use Portuguese colonial tongue shared by Brazilian President Lula da Silva. But when former Brazilian president came for a speech in Senegal, hundreds of Spanish-speaking well-wishers came with him, from activists draped in South American flags to Guatemalan Mayan women, and even Evo Morales, the first indigenous president of Bolivia. Their arrival comes at a time when analysts say Latin America is increasing ties with the continent to the east. The two land masses share cash crops and a history of 15th through 19th century colonial exploitation followed by 20th century military rule. But in the 21st century, De Silva says they share new opportunities due to tremendous economic growth. He says in the 29 countries he visited as president, he has been struck by the vitality with which Africa is affirming itself as a master of its destiny. Again, it looks like we need to keep an eye on what is happening in terms of relations between the Latin America, particularly Bolivia and Brazil. Because I know there's many, many things that have been happening in Brazil, and then definitely the continent. So with that, one of the things that we want to do is that we're going to play a little track for you in terms of, this comes from the Gypsy Kings. I know that it was an album, again, just highlighting some of their passion, and I think this is a great album. So here we go with stuff from the Gypsy Kings. While we get that on cue, we're going to continue on with some more news. We are looking at the role of African diaspora in the spotlight. So this was news that came from African News, and they were talking about the idea of the African diaspora is being declared a formal, institutionally recognized region of the continent is more gaining momentum as experts on the subject sit for a meeting in South Africa. Whenever this topic is considered, it evokes serious discussion, of which I'm sure will be the center of this meeting. As you're aware, this matter has not been finished, and as such, the interest has not been translated into functionally, fully structured integration of the diaspora into the African continent. In his opening address, that Frans Ben said African heads of state and government has expressed keen interest in the African diaspora being declared the sixth region of the continent. The two-day meeting brings together experts from the continent and its diaspora and marks the commencement of the implementation of the first key element of the African Union South African Diaspora Roadmap. So again, I think this is definitely a highlight and a key to, again, I think our recognizing there's a role that we play as people from the diaspora in the eyes of the people in the continent, and again, that need for partnership. So we're good. Sorry. As we continue, we are going to continue on with the news, and as we talk about Africa's new satellite blast into orbit. Intelsat New Dawn, Africa's new communication satellite, finally blasted into space via the Ariane 5 rocket, which to date has lifted off almost 60 times with satellite payloads. The satellite took off successfully on 22nd April from commercial space transport company Ariane Space Rocket Complex in French Guiana. Its initial launch on the 29th of March was aborted. Intelsat New Dawn is specifically designed to improve communications within the African continent. According to its owners, because it operates from a geostationary orbital slot at 32.8 degrees east, it is well placed to bolster Africa's telecommunications capacity. Now, definitely, this is always exciting news, and I'm looking forward to the day when Africa is able to launch its own spaceship, space probe, to be able to go where the rest of the world sort of has gone before. So I'm looking definitely forward to that. So I think it's very encouraging. Also, knowing all the resources and all the resources, but also all the capacities that the continent, people of the continent have. So now we're going to Ivory Coast. So Ivory Coast asked ICC to investigate human rights crimes. The Ivory Coast president, Ouattara, has asked the International Criminal Court to investigate allegations of serious human rights crimes committed during the country's recent turmoil. This was because Ivorian justice was not at this time best placed to reveal the most serious crimes. An estimated 3,000 people were killed during the four-month election dispute. More than 25,000 people are still living in the grounds of a church in the western city of Dioukouri. They say they fear for their safety because they belong to an ethnic group, the Guere. Seen as loyal to former President Gbagbo, who was arrested last month after refusing to accept defeat in last year's elections. Now we're going to continue the news as we go over to, well, we're looking at the Metropolitan Police pays damage over slave case woman. Now, this was, I think, news from the BBC, but let me see if I can just catch up on that one first. The four women, who are now in their mid-20s, say they were beaten and emotionally abused. The Metropolitan Police Service has been ordered to pay $5,000 to each of the four women for failing to investigate allegations of slavery. The women who arrived in London from Nigeria as children says they were beaten and emotionally abused by families they work for. The High Court said the force's failure to investigate breached the woman's human rights. The Met said it deeply regretted the women and deeply regretted that the woman did not get the service expected. So again, this is essentially about witnessing, being a witness and making sure that we're paying attention to what is happening to our people from different parts of the world. And I think one of the things that I recognize is that, you know, there is so much atrocities going on. And oftentimes the people who, when we don't pay attention, when we don't, when we're not witnesses and we don't, you know, let people know that we are watching what they do and we're paying attention and we care about the people that are from the continent or of the diaspora, then these atrocities continue to happen because we are not holding people responsible for the actions that they're taking. So now we're going to go over to... I know that we've probably heard a lot of news from Libya, so we're going to skip Libya for a little bit. I'm sure that there's going to be lots of discussions about Libya. We're going to go over to Egypt. So Egyptian mummy first to have diseased heart. An Egyptian princess who lived 3,500 years ago is thought to be the first known person to have developed heart disease, says researchers. Doctors believe the princess would have needed a heart bypass if she were living now. Scans showed she had extensive blockages in arteries leading to the heart, brain, stomach, and legs. The researcher says her case shows heart disease predates a modern lifestyle. Cardiac researchers from the U.S. teamed up with colleagues at Al Jazeera University in Cairo to analyze the remains of 52 mummies, including those of the princess. They have found evidence of hardening of the arteries in almost half of the mummies scanned, researchers told a medical conference in Amsterdam. So we're going to continue on our news as we're going to go back to South Africa again as we finish off. So Botswana strike closes hospitals. Some nurses shade from the sun at one of the daily demonstrations being held in the capital. Most of Botswana's clinics have closed and the main hospital in the capital, Gaborone, is barely functioning due to a civil strike over salaries. Earlier this week, the government sacked doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and cleaners who had joined a five-week strike in defiance of a court order. The government said essential staff were not allowed to strike. But the sackings have prompted nurses and doctors who have remained at work to join the industrial action. The government had offered a 3% conditional offer, but the union wanted a 12% wage increase, the reinstate of sacked workers, and the reversal of a no-work, no-pay condition. When the strike began last month, the union was demanding a 16% wage increase. It is running a skeletal service, mainly staffed with foreign workers and student nurses and doctors. Since the government has decided to fire our colleagues, we have decided to join the strike and mobilize other health professionals to do the same so that hospitals are left with no doctor or nurse. The reporter said the strike, which involves an estimated 100,000 people, has taken a heavy toll on public services. This week, the Minister of Education ordered that all government primary and secondary schools be shut until further notice. It seems like, again, there's lots of stuff happening in the continent, particularly, I think, when we pay attention to healthcare and health services and the conditions that people are working under, we need to be able to say something. We need to be able to recognize that all the resources that are coming out from the continent, all the resources that we get to benefit from, that people get at least more than a decent living wage. So I think, you know, the strike in Botswana especially, I know that one of the things a couple of years that was happening was that the U.S. and Canada was recruiting a lot of the nurses and doctors from the continent, and then again, you know, bring them over to North America, and then they would not get the same sort of the pay scale that other people from who are Canadian would get. So I think that is definitely something for us to recognize, that, you know, reaping those resources, those human resources, but also making sure that we are in support. So I will definitely encourage people, if you are in the healthcare field or if you're not, to keep on paying attention. And maybe one of the things that you can do is also, you know, write to your peers over in Botswana who are trying to make sure that they're getting a decent living wage, and supporting them and showing them that we are in support of the things that they're trying to do over there. So with that, that is all the news that we have for this week. Please remember that next week we are in celebration of African Liberation Day. Amandla and the whole Gorilla crew, we're going to be over at a different book list, which is Bathurst. So definitely give us a shout, show up, be in celebration, have some learnings, and definitely be in a community with a whole group of people. So that's next weekend on the 28th. And I'm your host, Audrey, for Amandla, and I'm going to shut down for the rest of today. And given that it could be the end of the world, I just like to remind people that just keep paying attention. If you're here, if the rapture didn't get you and you're here next week, please continue to listen on to the rest of Saturday Morning Live. And we'll see you next week.
Gotta figure out a way to go. Instead of moving on ahead, anyway, you come along with the fascinating desert for your bed. How exciting, such a lush poetic sight. Full of lots of lovely desert with a rare exotic mystery. Night, how you gonna be for a lovely night? Fell to the chant of the muezzin. I wanna be like a clown, here's your regular occurrence. Get off with the camel's back, put your antenna, play your hat down, ready to dream of what you like me while you're quietly sleeping soundly.
And you are listening to CKLN. This is Saturday Morning Live. And joining us on the line from London, England, is Dr. Gerald Horn. How are you doing, my good friend?
Fine. And yourself?
Oh, everything is everything. How is London? I know you like the food over there. How are you surviving?
Well, first of all, the prices in London give you an idea of what a weak U.S. dollar really means. When one is in London with these dollars, it's like having a monopoly money. I mean, I have to wonder how the people survive, given the strength of the pound, but obviously there's something I'm missing. I should also say that the austerity policies of the government of Tory Prime Minister David Cameron and his Liberal Democratic Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg, it's apparent. You see it in terms of the people in the streets, in terms of the high unemployment rates, etc. And as you may know, just recently you had an election in London that basically administered a stinging and pulverizing defeat to the Liberal Democrats. And for the life of me, I can't understand why a party that calls themselves liberal, which I assume means left of center, would enter into an alliance about a year ago with the Tories and spurning an alliance with the Labour Party, which one would think that they had more in common with. And I think that the verdict of the voters in this most recent election in Great Britain tells the tale as to the utter ridiculous nature of that alliance with the Conservatives. There's also an aspect of these recent elections in Great Britain that I think echo in Canada, and perhaps you would comment. That is to say that in Scotland, you have basically the most progressive sector of the British body politic. Not only that, in this recent election, the Scottish Nationalist Party, which in a sense is an analog of the Bloc in Quebec, did quite well, and they ate into the Labour Party cushion in Scotland, because the Labour Party voters in Scotland are Labour Party voters in Britain are disproportionately in Scotland. And I think one of the lessons of this most recent election in Britain is that if the Tories keep moving to the right with their Liberal Democratic Party allies, there's a possibility that Scotland will basically secede from the UK, marking the end of a 300-year experiment. Recall the Act of Union of 1707 basically led to the accession of Scotland into the United Kingdom. And I wonder if there is an echo in Canada, recent elections, which I don't think we've had a chance to talk about. That is to say, we know that the NDP did quite well in Quebec and that the Tories did not do very well in Quebec. And I'm wondering if the signal to Ottawa is that if the Tories under Mr. Harper keep moving to the right, will that somehow be a factor in igniting a new wave of secession of sentiment in Quebec?
I think he is aware of that. Now, whether or not he can reverse his position, I don't know. Let me say that the question of Quebec is Quebec. The province of Quebec is without a doubt, from a working class point of view, is the most progressive spot in Canada, and some might argue in North America. However, they're pretty bad on the issue of Islamophobia. The whole question of Muslims and race issues, but that's another issue that we can talk about. But Harper has made a lot of inroads among. They have really been grooming the South Asian community, the African community, and they have done a job just like Rob Ford, who is the new mayor of Toronto, who has made an alliance with Stephen Harper, has made some inroads with Africans, African people, South Asians, and he's trying to make some inroads with the Chinese. And I think that Harper is aware of this, but I don't know if he can flip-flop on Quebec, because the Quebecois are like on the question of take the international issues, the Quebecois don't want to have anything to do with any type of war. As I mean, as a people, trade union wise, they are strong, stronger than strong in terms of the union movement is strong there. The whole question of the health care and I should say daycare, they have maybe the most progressive daycare system in probably North America. So I know people always talk about how, you know, the children can go to, parents are free to work in Quebec because you can $5, I don't know what it is, but it's a ridiculously low amount of money that people pay for child care. So I think it's going to be very difficult for Mr. Harper, to use your term, to gain any sort of traction in Quebec. He is but this will really blow your mind. We're going to have a provincial election in Ontario, and people are worried that you will have a Rob Ford in Toronto, a gentleman by the name of Hudak. He could win Ontario, and then Harper has a majority government in Canada. I mean, in federally across the whole nation, and we should. I think we should really mention the fact that Harper only got less than 40% of the electorate voted for him. So it's not like he really has a majority. That's really a joke. But he is to sum up. I don't know if he can take Quebec because Quebec is. Basically say, and they're not necessarily putting the question of nationhood on hold. They're basically saying that the NDP embraces a lot of their social democratic tendencies, but they will put that the national question on hold for a time being because Jack Layton's policies, or not necessarily Jack Layton policies, but social democracy is more appealing to the Quebecois, if that answers your question.
Well, one of the questions that I still have is this. You mentioned that the Tories under Mr. Harper have been catering to the new immigrant population.
Big time.
From Asia and Africa.
Yes.
My question is, haven't the Liberals and NDP been catering to those populations as well? And given that those populations are mostly working class, why don't Liberal and NDP policies resonate more? Or is it that this question of family values and so-called traditional mores that the Tories demagogically put forward resonate with these populations in a climate, in a nation, in a world environment where obviously women's role is under assault and man's role is changing? And is that perhaps have something to do with why some of these new immigrant populations might vote Tory?
Let me say this. The Liberal Party did little or nothing. I would go so far as to say nothing to appeal to the so-called ethnic vote because they had it wrapped up because of Trudeau. I mean, the Liberal Party took the immigrant vote, the African and the South Asian vote and the Asian vote for granted because Trudeau brought all of the new immigrants into Canada. So therefore, and I'm not really exaggerating. I know people that the Liberals never even came to their house. They used to come and knock on their door. Joe Valpy, for example, he was, I think he used to write for the Globe and Mail, very progressive man, liberal. I mean, for a liberal, he didn't really do any work. He lost his seat. And the NDP, I went to Mr. Layton's when he did his inaugural speech. There were not too many of us there. They did a lot better than the Liberals, but I think the NDP has dropped the ball slightly when it comes to catering to especially the African vote. When I say African, I'm speaking of African people from all over the world who live in this particular country. Now, that is really kind of it's really sad, I voiced my opinion on that. But the Ignatieff is, I think you characterize the Nazi as very well. I mean, he is an arrogant guy. And, you know, people are saying that, you know, one of the reasons why Rob Ford won the mayoral thing, one of the things that got him elected was the fact that he, two or three days before the election, he appealed to the religious element in the immigrant community. Our people, many immigrants, are Muslims or Christians, or they have a religious belief that homosexuality is against God. So Rob Ford, there, one of the guys he was running against, Smitherman, was openly gay, had just was in a same-sex marriage, and what's his name? Two or three days before the election, he dropped that on the electorate. I was speaking to a guy by the name of Jules Elders, who used to be an editor of one of the Caribbean newspapers up here, and he maintains that this is what drove the a lot of the immigrant vote to Ford. And I think that, you know, a lot of these things have to be taken into consideration.
Well, I guess that suggests that hypothesis put forward about family value.
Oh, you're right.
And the assault on women's role.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that man's role is obviously in a state of flux, particularly if you look not only in the United States, but I would say worldwide with this economic recession. It's been described as a man-cession in terms of the decline of manufacturing sector in the North Atlantic community, which has disproportionately affected male workers. And at the same time, you have rising social movements, particularly the gay, lesbian, and transgender movement, which is something new in historical terms, particularly in the last few decades. And I think a lot of this has led to a state of flux that many people find difficult to explain, others find difficult to accept. And demagogically, the Tories and the conservative parties globally have been trying to play upon that, and of course they're going to play upon that in the coming election in France in particular, because if you look at what's happened with Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who was slated to be the next president of France, the present or actually recently resigned leader of the International Monetary Fund, it's suspected that the fascist party of Marine Le Pen, whose father, of course, was highly anti-Semitic, and she has basically tried to transmute that into being Islamophobic, that she may, in fact, be the ultimate victor, at least in the short-term sense, not necessarily in terms of the election, but in terms of garnering votes from Mr. Strauss-Kahn's spectacular fall. It has come out in the media, of course, that the chambermaid, to use the British term, that Mr. Strauss-Kahn assaulted, in fact, raped, as I understand it, in Manhattan just some days ago, was a Muslim woman
from Guinea, right?
And, of course, not only is this a metaphor for how the International Monetary Fund has dealt with Africa, but as well, it's something of a metaphor, if not a reality, of how the colonial powers have dealt with Africa as well. And we should not forget, for example, that the Ku Klux Klan, when it had its second iteration at the time of World War I, approximately 90 years ago, it grew spectacularly in the United States, not only because of its traditional bashing of people of African descent, not only because of its traditional bashing of Catholics and those who were Jewish, but also because the Ku Klux Klan said that it was the defender of white womanhood against the changing role of women that was seen as pushing them down a notch or two on the ladder. And that's basically going to be the pitch that the neo-fascist party makes in France in this upcoming election.
You're listening to Saturday Morning Live. My name is Norman Richmond. I'm on the line with Dr. Gerald Horn, who is in London, England, the author of many, many, many books. And before I ask you the next question, when is your next book coming out? And the Hawaii book is the next one coming out?
That's right. The Fighting in Paradise, Labor Unions, Racism, and Communists, and the Making of Modern Hawaii. It'll be out in a few weeks, actually, from the University of Hawaii Press. And then The next one after that will be out at the end of the year. Negro Comrades of the Crown, African Americans of the British Empire Fight the United States Before Emancipation. This book has a lot of Canadian content. It deals with the Africans who came from the United States, went into exile in places like Ontario, and then used Ontario as a rear base from which to launch attacks on the U.S. slave system. Not only that, but from Bermuda and Bahamas as well. It's a story that needs to be told, and I have to say it's rather shocking that it has not been told to this point.
Now, this guy, Strauss Kahn, has been described as a caviar socialist. And, you know, socialism is democratic. So I keep on trying to stress to people, and I guess you probably have taught political science classes. I mean, we have everything from Fabian socialists to scientific socialists and democratic socialists in the middle. And, you know, some people were really having a fit because when the NGOs and non-governmental organizations, or some people say nothing going on, go to Haiti, they stay in these hotels that cost $175 per night. Whereas this guy, Strauss Kahn, I've heard the hotel he was staying at with the lowest was $2,000 per night, and the highest is like $5,000 per night. I mean, how can a guy like this, don't you think that first of all, calling himself, or you know, being associated with a socialist party, don't you think that gives the whole question of the left a bad name, you know, by living, I have nothing against living in a hotel, and if you go into a five-star hotel, that's fine, but $5,000, $2,000 a night, what's that all about?
Well, obviously there are contradictions in the Social Democratic Project. That's no secret. Obviously there are contradictions within the French Socialist Party, that a man like Dominic Strauss-Kahn, who after all had a reputation going back years for assaulting women, had been called on the carpet by the International Monetary Fund for sexual harassment. One has to wonder how this is consonant with socialist ideals. But the fact of the matter is, and it should be noted, that his spouse, Anne Sinclair, is a multimillionaire. Her family had very close ties with Pablo Picasso, and that has helped to lead to her accumulating a small fortune. I think that one of the Picasso paintings that she was associated with was recently sold, and this is just one painting, for $33 million. So it's not impossible that when Mr. Strauss-Kahn was staying at the Sofitel Hotel in Midtown Manhattan, that he was picking up the tab himself, and if he's a multimillionaire, I guess
he can do what he wants to do.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's not as if he was, I assume, perhaps not staying at the expense of the International Monetary Fund. But in any case, there's a lot of contradictions. But I have to say, at this point in history, in this point in time, even though I note those contradictions, I think that the right is so strong in the North Atlantic community that we have to find and take allies basically wherever we can take them. And if Mr. Strauss-Kahn wants to sign on to the left, well, I think that's better than his signing on to the right.
Now, I wanted to move on to last year, or 2 years ago, we tried to celebrate Black History Month, and President Barack Obama changed Black History Month, not Black Music Month, to African American Appreciation Month, and then he did a job where he, I think June is also African Caribbean American Month, and so on and so forth. That's one thing. The whole Black Music Month is coming up next month. I want to ask you that as a small question, but the bigger question is, could you analyze the speech that President Obama made on the Middle East policy and his whole thing? It looks like he managed to piss everybody off. Netanyahu was mad at him. The PLO is mad at him. Many elements of the left in North America are mad at him. What exactly did our brother and comrade Barack Hussein Obama say that was so that has got the world talking again.
Well, the centerpiece of the remarks that he made at the U.S. State Department within the last 48 hours was that there should be a settlement of this longstanding dispute between the Israelis and the Palestinians based upon the 1967 borders, that is to say, before the Israeli invasion and takeover of the West Bank and Gaza as a result of the Six-Day War, June 1967. Now, Mr. Netanyahu and the right wing in Israel say that that is an indefensible border position. But in any case, Mr. Obama had said that the negotiations should be based upon that should be the starting point. What it's the end point is a separate question altogether. I think that somehow got lost in translation. But I think the major weakness of Mr. Obama's remarks was the failure to say anything about Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
I think that Saudi Arabia is a major problem, not only for the United States, but for the world. I say that not only because 15 of the 19 hijackers on September 11, 2001 were Saudi, that Mr. Osama bin Laden, although of Yemeni extraction, was also from a prominent Saudi family. It's well known that the Taliban elements in Afghanistan, and also the Pakistani Taliban to a certain degree, are funded by wealthy Gulf Arabs, including Saudis. It's well known that the Saudis have very close ties to the Pakistanis, and as you know, it's probably accurate to say that there were elements in Pakistan that were basically sheltering Osama bin Laden, just like they're sheltering those who have made, for example, the assault on Mumbai in November 2008 that led to the slaughter of countless scores of individuals. The Saudis also helped to prop up the United States government by buying U.S. Treasury bills, that is to say, U.S. government debt, which keeps the government running. There are Saudi princes who basically are major stockholders in Fox News, this propaganda channel that tilts the U.S. population, at least the Euro-American sector, so far to the right. And at the same time, the Saudis have now been trying to orient their foreign policy towards China, just like the Pakistanis have, their close allies. You might have noted that just within the last 48 hours, the Pakistani prime minister was in Beijing, and he has returned with quite a gift basket, including 50 new fighter jet planes, which I'm sure is going to cause nervousness in New Delhi, because that'll probably be the ultimate target. There's been serious talk that there could even be a war between nuclear-armed Pakistan and the United States because of the Pakistan upset about what has been characterized as a violation of their sovereignty when on May 2nd, the United States came into Pakistan and killed, we are told, Osama bin Laden. Now, I should say that there is also evidence to suggest that certain elements in the Pakistani government might have been witting about the United States coming into Pakistan on May 2nd, 2011. After all, those helicopters that came across the border from Afghanistan, Pakistan's neighbor to the west, it's difficult to believe they were not detected by radar. Now, we've been fed the story that they were stealth helicopters, but Robert Baer, a former CIA agent well-connected, it was his memoir on which the movie Syriana with George Clooney was based and filmed. Robert Baer says that he's flown on those helicopters, and it's hard to believe that they could not have been detected, that there's not that much stealth in the world. So I say all this to say that two things. Number one, Mr. Obama's speech neglected Saudi Arabia, and that was a glaring omission, although it's perhaps understandable because even though it's hard for people in the United States to believe, Saudi Arabia has enormous leverage in the United States. And just like it's very difficult for countries across the world to cross the United States, it's very difficult for the United States to cross Saudi Arabia, and that's a very difficult pill to swallow for some. And the second point that I'm making with regard to Osama bin Laden, something we also haven't talked about, is that there's so much murkiness with regard to those events on May 2nd that it's difficult to come to firm conclusions about some basic fundamental points, such as was Pakistan's sovereignty violated on May 2nd?
Yep.
Was the killing of Mr. Bin Laden a targeted assassination?
Yes.
Or was it analogous to the Israelis 50 years ago going into South America and kidnapping Adolf Eichmann and leading a Nazi military man and bringing him back to Israel to be tried and where he was convicted? We won't know about that second point, I think, for some years to come until some of the files are revealed that are now secret and confidential, and also when the memoirs start pouring out, as inevitably they will.
We are attempting to contact a comrade of ours that we actually used to sing with. There was a young man by the name of Sagidi Abdullah, a.k.a. Carl Dice, who passed away recently. And Sagidi Abdullah was a friend of mine who I used to actually sing with. And he passed away recently. They're having a memorial for him today in Leimert Park in Los Angeles, California. And Sagidi wrote and produced Baby Take Your Time, Do It Right for the SOS Band. Think Twice for Donald Byrd, which was recorded by Erykah Badu. He worked with Eddie Kendricks of the Temptations and Felipe Wynn and Alexander O'Neill. I wanted to ask you a couple of more questions before we go to Sagidi. I guess you know Sagidi's music yourself. Coming,
absolutely.
Yeah, and I think the Sagidi Take Your Time by the SOS Band, according to Billboard, was the number 10 R&B record of all time. I remember I phoned Sagidi and told him that I had picked up the Billboard when I used to read it religiously. And yeah, he was very, very, very happy about that. And Sagidi was a brother who we went to LA, Los Angeles City College together. And at that particular time, Al Prentice Bunchy Carter was there, who went on to lead the Black Panther Party. Earl Randall was there, who went on to work with Al Green. He went to High Records. Who else was there? Fred Goray, who went on to become Masai Kariga Kenyatta. Fred Goray, he was a big DJ in Detroit. He was born and raised in your hometown, St. Louis, Missouri. Sagidi was there. So we had the people that went to LACC at that particular time, you know, went on to do a lot of things. I just want to ask you a couple of questions about the basketball playoffs, and what do you think about your Blue Jays now?
Well, Mr. Jose Bautista obviously has vindicated those in the Toronto Blue Jays organization who rewarded him with a big contract. I mean, he's been tearing up the league, and I have to say that I am a bit surprised. I didn't know that he would be able to do this consistently. I do think the Blue Jays miss Vernon Wells. I think that they will come to rue the day that they let him go, and I'm curious to hear what you have to say about that. Now, with regard to the playoffs, I still have to believe the Miami Heat will prevail, not least because they have the best player in the game, who happens to be LeBron James, but also because of the supporting cast, which I'm sure could be considered a misnomer, because Dwayne Wade could hardly be considered a part of a supporting cast, as he's one of the top five players in the league, and the former resident of Toronto, Mr. Chris Bosh, I think has been vindicating those who had put faith in him with his performances in recent days.
In terms of Vernon Wells, Vernon was traded, I think, to, was it the Angels of Anaheim?
The Los Angeles Angels at Anaheim.
The last time I had heard about Vernon was not doing well at all. Now they have a new gentleman named Rajai Davis, who is he might be able to outrun Tyson Gay. This guy is stealing bases like mad. But I listened to some of the Caucasian critics. They say he can't catch, you know, in terms of he And then this other guy, Corey Patterson, who's playing left field, they're criticizing him because he's afraid to get hurt, so he won't go. He won't do the Willie Mays stuff, you know, or the Jamaican brother who used to play center field for the Devon White. He won't, you know. He's a pretty guy. He doesn't want to hurt himself, so he's being criticized that. But
what do they say about Bautista?
Everybody is basically they're eating their words now because there's one thing that you didn't mention. I know you're aware of it. Bautista took time off because his wife had a baby, so he missed some games. Then he was hurt for a minute, so he hasn't really played. I mean, he's hit all of these home runs with time off, and you know, he hit three the other day, back to back. So he has silenced his critics. You know, there are some people that are talking about the juice, but that's becoming less and less of an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So, is there anything else you'd like to add? And we will be talking to you from the same spot next week.
Yes. And I'll look forward to that. Take care.
All right. We have been speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn. This is Saturday Morning Live, and we are going to continue. We're going to hook up with Dar El Malik Bey.
Every night I cry, every night I wonder why you treat me cold, yet you won't let me go. Every little hurt counts, every little hurt counts. You say you're coming home, yet you never phone, leave me all alone. My love is strong for you, I'll do wrong for you. The loneliness you give me, yeah. I can't go on giving my life away. Oh, come back to me, darling. You see, I can give you all the things that you wanted before. Stay with me, yeah. Every little bit hurts, every little bit hurts. To you I'm a toy that you can enjoy anytime you think that you want to play. Yeah, you hurt me, desert me. All the things that you want.